Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, folks. Here I am, delighted as always to be talking to the best audience in the entire field. What field? Well, it's the field of everything. Psychology, social work, psychiatry, philosophy about human beings and mind, how to live life. It's just a great thing to be talking to all of you. My guest today is a very interesting man, Andrew Thebold. Andrew is doing remarkable work. I don't know that he ever had any training in the mental health field. I know he's a technological whiz. He's been doing things that I wish I were able to do in regard to evaluating data with computers that he sets on fire and then leaves and comes back, I don't know, days later and has got all kinds of information. He'll tell you about that. He's co-founder of Parents Against Pharmaceutical Abuse, PAPA, P-A-P-A, co-founder. Parents Against Pharmaceutical Abuse. He's got a very good website. I think he probably created that himself as well. He is a blogger, as I am, on Madden America. And he has recently written a blog that everyone should go and have a look at on Mad in America. And he's going to be talking about some of the things he's found in that blog, some of the astonishing results of surveying FDA summary reports and obtaining the individual, actual, original clinical reports on hundreds of cases of death, violence, suicide. His focus, and I'm very grateful to him for this, is on children. I welcome Andrew to the show. His last name is spelled T-H-I-B-A-U-L-T. Andrew, are you there?
I'm here, Dr. Breggin, and thank you. It's an honor to be a guest on your show. It's actually pronounced Thibault the French way, so the L and the T are silent.
Thibault.
Yep.
Thibault. Not Thibault, but Thibault.
Thibault, like the quarterback, just spelled
French
way.
Like the quarterback, okay. T-H-I-B-A-U-L-T.
That's correct.
Thibault. Thank you, Andrew. The only language I took was 4 years of Latin in high school. It's proven to be of less use than originally claimed, but interesting. Andrew, I could just give you the mic for an hour, but I'm going to try to have a conversation with you. You have so much to tell us. Start with how you got involved with all of this, and then let's look at the results that you describe in your latest blog on Madness in America and results you haven't as yet publicized in regard to adverse drug effects.
Well, Dr. Breggin, as you kind of surmised at the beginning, I don't have any background in psychology or psychiatry or mental health work. I'm just a parent. My child was caught up in the ADHD diagnosis dragnet, as many millions of other children have been in this country. And so I set about to try to understand as much as I could initially about stimulant medications. And you're correct in pointing out that I do have a background in information technology, so a lot of times I look at things from a technology perspective because technology can get us to think about things differently. You know, Uber has really changed the way we think about transportation. personal transportation. Airbnb has changed the way we think about lodging. And I think technology is going to change the way we think about drug risk information. At least that's been my experience. So it wasn't long after I started doing research on the stimulant medication that I stumbled onto what's called MedWatch, or the FDA Adverse Event Reporting System, that they abbreviate as FAERS. And it turns out that the FDA releases on a quarterly basis data files that document all of the adverse event reports that have been filed over over a quarter. So I took, and there's probably about 250,000 roughly on average events per quarter. So I took these and I normalized them into a relational database. Now, they're not encrypted or anything, but they might as well be for the average person because they're only machine-readable. But once I got these into a database, and there's close to 20 million records, Dr. Bregan, so this is a lot of information, I started to run queries against them. And of course, because of my particular interest with my life experience with my child, I was looking specifically for stimulant medication side effects. One of the first things that I found that was very troubling, Dr. Brain, was that 287 children had reportedly died between 2004 and the 2014 timeframe. And that's on drugs like methylphenidate or Ritalin, Concerta, Vyvanse, Adderall, a typical stimulant medication that's prescribed for kids with ADHD. Now, as I started digging further into that, I stumbled across a HHS testimony in a Senate hearing in which they estimated that the MedWatch system only amounts to between 1 and 10% of the actual number of cases. And that's because in terms of physicians, it's a voluntary system of reporting. So physicians aren't required necessarily to report when a patient experiences an adverse event. So that's staggering, really, when you think about it, that there could be anywhere between 2,800 and 28,000 children who've died on stimulant medication in this country, especially when you think about what the downside is, right? So stimulant medication is used to treat children who have difficulty with focus and attention. So that's a really steep price to pay for focus and attention. So that was one of my initial findings, and it was so troubling. I started to wonder what other types of medications had this type of deadly or fatal side effect for children.
Andrew, let me ask, this is such important data right now, it's almost worth taking a breath and saying, you found 280 deaths. If you figure like the FDA does that only 1% to 10% get reported, that's 2,800 to 28,000. My guess is not even 1 in 100 get reported. All the deaths that I've seen in my legal work, none of them have ever been reported, except for the mass shootings that I've been an expert in. Those get reported sometimes. The other thing, to give the setting to this, I don't think you said over how many years of use these 20 million roughly records were. I think it will help folks to know, was it 5 years, 6 years? What's the time span?
Yeah, it was roughly between 2004 and 2014, so over a period of a decade.
Great. All right, well, go on. You were about to say that, all right, the first thing you looked at were these deaths from stimulants, and then what happened? By the way, mostly children, right? That's going to be the vast majority children?
Oh, yeah. So everything I'm talking about up until now is children, so 18, under the age of 18, right? So that's 287 children. There are many many adults who've died on the medication as well, as you might well imagine, because of the cardiovascular complications. But just to confirm what you said, anecdotally, so we have two parents in our group who've experienced the most tragic loss Their children died as a result of stimulant medication. Neither one of them has reported it to MedWatch. So really, to underscore your point there, there's a lot of underreporting going on.
Yeah, and you say neither of them and neither of their doctors, I assume.
That's my understanding.
Yeah.
It's not something doctors necessarily want to admit, right, that they prescribed the drug that might have contributed to the death of a child.
That's right. That's why I think it's less than 1 in 100 that get reported, would be my guess. But you're making your point really well. And the next thing you decided to look at, Andrew?
Well, I was so troubled by the stimulant medication pediatric fatalities that I expanded the search to include all psychotropic medications. Now, unfortunately, there wasn't a readily available list of all psychotropic medications, so I had to put that together to include, you know, all the different types: antipsychotics, anxiolytics, hypnotic sedatives, mood stabilizers, stimulant drugs, and you have to include the brand names as well as the generic names. So once I had that list together, compiled, I then ran the query and found some more disturbing information. So inclusive of the stimulant deaths, there were, during the same period, 1,889 pediatric deaths associated with all of the psychotropic medications. So again, almost 1,900 cases, and if we extrapolate the HHS estimate of that only representing between 1 and 10% of the actual number of cases, you know, we're looking at it anywhere between 19,000 and 190,000 children who've died on this medication. It's really a staggering number.
And give me that first number again. It was
1,889 who reported died on the psychotropic medications.
This is like staggering information. So now we're up to total pediatric deaths just on recognized psychotropic drugs at 100 and I'd say probably around a 200,000 range per year. It's for these 10 years. Then there's going to be folks, a lot of other pediatric deaths on other medications. Mm-hmm. Suicides. Do these include suicides, these fatalities?
They do.
Yeah. And there's a lot of antibiotic medications used with children are associated with depression and death. So they're going to be even more than this. But, of course, our huge concern that we share, Andrew and I, is the psychiatric meds. And so we have these huge numbers. Where did you go from here?
Well, just to put that in perspective as well, Dr. Bragan, you know, cynics may look at that and say there's no way that 200,000 children have died on these medications. And, you know, I always refer back to the case of Vioxx. As you know, the FDA medical doctor and epidemiologist, Dr. David Graham, estimated there were 130,000 heart attacks, about 40% of which were fatal in his estimation. And that's on one medication. You know, here we're talking about a list of medication that's in the hundreds. So it's a plausible number, shocking, but plausible.
I hear you. All right. So what did you start looking at next?
Well, curiosity got the better of me, Dr. Bragan, and I was really curious what these children were suffering from when they died. And so there's a separate table of reactions, and I joined those together with the results that I'd already tallied. And though tragic, it wasn't surprising the types of reactions that the children had. Things like cardiac arrest, respiratory arrest, hepatotoxicity, Stevens-Johnson syndrome, toxic epidermal necrolysis, neuroleptic malignant syndrome, completed suicides, as you mentioned, and then one that just seemed really out of place, homicide. So I was like, wait, what? Murder? as a reported side effect. And I dismissed it out of hand. It wasn't until the second or third time that I saw it that it finally registered, and the light bulb went off. And so I went back to the database, and I did a query, and sure enough, there were over 700 cases of homicides reported as a possible adverse drug reaction. So I knew I had stumbled onto something really that hasn't been very well publicized, and I had become aware that you could request the actual case narratives associated with these electronic reports that I was looking at in a database format. So back in, I guess it was October of 2014, I made a Freedom of Information Act request to the FDA, and I requested these 700-plus cases. And unfortunately, our drug regulatory agency, which you would hope would be very proactive in warning consumers about potential drug risks, seemed to just be dragging their feet. And 10 months went by where I tried unsuccessfully to get these files until finally I had to file a federal lawsuit. So in August of 2015, I sued the FDA to obtain these files. And by November of 2015, they had coughed up 3,000 or so pages of adverse event reports. So I've been going through those, and the stories are just horrific, Dr. Bregan, as you can imagine, just heartbreaking. Story after story of families being destroyed, mothers killing their children, fathers killing their children, spouses killing their spouses, the children killing their parents, all on the medication. And what's really troubling is that many of the documents have been heavily redacted. And I say heavily, Dr. Bregan, because previously when I was researching the pediatric psychotropic fatalities, I had already had the opportunity to review some of these adverse event reports, and they were either not redacted or very sparsely redacted. So this is a red flag to see all of this redaction in these reports. And some of the redactions have to do with how long before these horrific tragedies the person started taking the medication. And the FDA is claiming a privacy exemption, and it's really seems very incredible to try to claim a privacy exemption on, you know, how long a person was taking medication prior to a tragedy. So it really seems like they're trying to cover up the data, which in and of itself is distressing.
Yeah, my experience over the years now has been that the FDA is more the advocate of the drug companies than their monitor. I call them a toothless watchdog that became a house pet and then a lap dog. It just isn't doing its job, and it obstructs in many cases, as you're finding, can be very obstructive. When I first got involved with the Prozac issue and the high rates of violence and suicide on Prozac back in the 1990s, we found out the FDA would hold secret early morning before the buildings opened meetings with Eli Lilly to try to smooth out these things and, and all the turmoil that was developing in the public. And I remember when my book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, back in 1983, and a TV show with Dan Rather that I did, forced the FDA to upgrade the labels for tardive dyskinesia. Paul Lieber, who was the head of the psychotropic drug group at the FDA, actually lamented that he'd been forced to do this, but promised not to do anything in writing. He said this at the first meeting with the drug companies, promised not to do anything that would harm them, harm their interests. So how can you actually effectively increase the warnings for severe adverse effects without, quote, harming the interests of the drug companies? So the culture there is to pounce on anybody within the FDA who wants to tell the truth and to, as much as possible, prepare yourself for double dipping after you finish your retirement by going to work for a drug company, which is what Lieber, the gentleman I was telling you about, did. He went to work as a consultant for drug companies after he left. So he was tilling the ground. Wow, you're making things very clear. Please, go on.
It does seem like there is a conflict of interest in many cases, with the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research being both the approver of the drug and reviewing the post-marketing adverse event reports. So oftentimes, as you know, the medical reviewers are discouraged from issuing findings that would adversely affect the drug. You know, case in point was the antidepressants, which you have so much intimate familiarity with, and the pressure that was put on Dr. Andrew Mossholder when his results didn't conform to what they wanted. But I think perhaps they've learned some lessons since then, because while the agency was dragged kicking and screaming to put a black box warning for increased risk of suicidality after congressional hearings and a lot of bad press, what's interesting to note, Dr. Bregan, is the FDA has been quietly, with no fanfare, putting homicidal ideation warnings on the drug labels. So we already have a handful of drugs that do have homicidal ideation warnings on them. Effexor is one of the drugs, which is venlafaxine, and Wellbutrin and Zyban, both really the same drug, bupropion, but one prescribed as an antidepressant, the other is a smoking cessation drug. Chantix, also known as varenicline, has a homicidal ideation warning on it. And Vyvanse, the most commonly prescribed drug for ADHD, or lisdexamfetamine, also has a homicidal ideation warning, which was put on there after we had a horrible incident down here in Florida, where I live, at Florida State University, where a 31-year-old attorney went into the Strozier Library on campus and started shooting people. They found that he had 0.24 milligrams of amphetamine in his blood at the time of death. There's a new drug called Adzenys, XROTT, which is amphetamine, essentially for kids. It's a new flavored dissolving amphetamine tablet that's essentially biosimilar, bioequivalent to Adderall, and it has a homicidal ideation warning on the label. What's really troubling is that Shire, who's the manufacturer of Vyvanse and Adderall, applied for approval for a chewable version of Vyvanse on April 14th of this year. Now, leading up to a pediatric advisory committee meeting, the FDA released some briefing materials that I happened to peruse, and I found a case that was summarized within the Vyvanse pediatric safety review describing a 10-year-old girl who was prescribed Vyvanse and fed her medication to a 3-month-old baby girl before suffocating the girl to death. So this just so happens to correspond to one of the reports that I had requested, Dr. Bregan. So I immediately brought this to the attention of the FDA and the assistant U.S. attorney that's working on this case. And rather than turn over the report, which they had previously released in this briefing materials, they went back and redacted the case summary. So in effect, they just made it disappear. So a day after the manufacturer applied for a chewable version of the drug, obviously targeting young children, the FDA covered up this 10-year-old girl who had been prescribed Vyvanse and killed a 3-month-old baby girl. It's really shameful behavior on their part.
What's the status? We've talked about this on our radio show. What's the status of the chewable?
Well, because that that application's just been made, it's going to take a little while to work its way through the system. The Adzenys is a dissolving tablet that's already approved. It was approved in January of this year.
Spell that, would you?
Adzenys, A-D-Z-E-N-Y-S, and then it's an extended release XR-ODT. Now, there already is a drug called Quilichew, which is the chewable version of Quillivant, which is methylphenidate. So essentially, we have chewable speed for kids, and now it's coming out that, children as young as 10 years old have, killed other young children on the drug.
This is such important work you're doing. Go ahead.
Well, Dr. Bregan, I never... never in a million years did I think when I went, plumbing the depths of this data for stimulant medication adverse events that I would stumble over this. And of course, it's just too serious to walk away from. Otherwise, they probably would have. And it's something that the American public needs to know. And it's really troubling that the FDA is trying to cover this up. So getting back to these adverse event reports, I've kind of categorized these, and it probably won't shock you that about 45% of the reports have to do with antidepressants. I know you've done quite a bit of work regarding the link between antidepressants and violence.
Now, the reports you're talking about are the homicide reports.
That's correct.
45, no, it doesn't surprise me. 45% of the homicide reports are related to the antidepressants. No, and can you say, is it mostly the new ones?
So this is over a 10-year period, and you raise a good point, right? So this is going to implicate the older generation, but there already are cases of the newer ones. And so that's a really good point because, there's this phenomenon of, I guess what I call 2.0 or 3.0 drugs, that the FDA has established this trend of approving essentially what are isomers or active metabolites of existing drugs as what's known as an NME or new molecular entity. And this really achieves a number of goals. One is it kind of allows the agency and the drug company to rehabilitate the active ingredient because the brand names of the drugs are changed essentially to protect those who aren't innocent. So the American public is none the wiser thinking that, they're taking a new generation of drugs. And unfortunately, the warnings aren't necessarily carried over to the new drug. So case in point, Effexor that we mentioned. Now that drug, the FDA required a homicidal ideation warning on the Effexor or venlafaxine label after a mother killed her 5 children while on the drug. But what's significant, in addition to the warning, is where on the label that the FDA placed the warning. It's in the pre-marketing evaluation section of the drug's label, meaning that the manufacturer and possibly even the FDA knew about the homicidal ideation before the drug was even approved. Well, now the successor to Effexor is Prestique and Cadezla, or desvenlafaxine. But neither of those biosimilar drugs carry a homicidal ideation warning on the label. So that's a very good point, because the names are getting changed here, but the entity isn't necessarily any different from a chemical standpoint. So the FDA, as you kind of alluded to before, pockets money, $2.3 million for each new drug application for this biosimilar drug. The pharmaceutical company is rewarded with NME and what they call NCE status, or new chemical entity. And that buys them another 5 to 7 years of exclusivity so that lesser expensive generics can't compete. And then, as I pointed out, oftentimes those very troubling warnings don't carry over to the new drug. Another example, this one an antipsychotic, is aripiprazole, known as Abilify. And the FDA waited 13 years to put an uncontrollable harmful urges warning on that drug, and that was only after the original drug lost its exclusivity. So the FDA has recently approved a new drug. It's called brexpiprazole. The brand name is Rexulti. And they didn't even refer that drug to an advisory committee prior to approval. And the reason that they gave was that the drug is so similar to aripiprazole. And aripiprazole has a 13-year safety record. But ironically, the agency then turned around and withheld the uncontrollable harmful urges warning from the new drug. And the reason they gave was because there were no similar post-marketing surveillance reports for the new drug. Well, of course there weren't, because it was just approved. So that's the problem, is these drugs are getting recycled, and oftentimes the warnings aren't carrying over. So we may have another window, Dr. Bregan, of 10 years before we find out that these drugs cause the same sort of side effects as their sort of parent drugs. Another case in point would be Savella, which is milnacipran. It's a drug to treat fibromyalgia, and it has a homicidal ideation warning on the label. Well, the same drug is marketed under the name Fetzima, and it's levomilnacipran, used for treatment of major depressive disorder, and there's no homicidal ideation warning on the label. So this is happening quite a bit, where they're splicing these drugs, calling it something different, and the homicidal ideation warnings aren't following the new drug.
This is some of the most interesting information I've ever heard on my radio show.
From an unlikely person, because like I said, this is just something that I started to research as a result of my son, being caught up in this dragnet. So
remind folks, we're talking with Andrew Thibault. He is a non-professional in our field. What is your profession? I know you do technology work of some sort with the computers. What would you describe yourself as?
Yeah, I have an information technology consulting business.
Information technology. Wow. That's broad, isn't it?
It is. It's really what gave me the conceptual framework to be able to view this adverse event information a little bit differently. And I would say, what's a shame here, Dr. Bregan, is that doctors should know about this information, but they don't. It took somebody to crack a database to be able to decipher this information. So it's very concerning that doctors don't have this information. And so I really do thank you for bringing me on the show, because this is a start to try to get this information out there.
Yes, and you and I are going to find some way, hopefully, as we discussed before the show yesterday, to work together to get this out. Clearly, you're just doing incredibly important work. And again, folks, we've been just talking for most of the time about homicide. And that's a very narrow kind of an adverse event. Interestingly enough, as Andrew is well aware, Thomas More and Joe Glenn Mullen published a paper in which they also looked at the FDA data, some of it overlapping with the years that Andrew Thibault is looking at. And they found increased rates of violence in proportion to the numbers of prescriptions. They figured that in. And there was a great elevation And the number one drug was that smoking drug, varenicline.
Varenicline, yes. And, you know, it's really, it's shameful to see the efforts of Pfizer now to rehabilitate that drug. There have been a number of so-called studies that have been circulated around since the more et al. Report in PLOS-1. And, you know, it's very different from the well-founded research that those doctors did. It's essentially just trying to gloss over the very serious psychiatric side effects of the drug. You know, we even have this effort underway. I remember a piece that was in Time magazine in 2014 trying to rehabilitate antidepressants and say that, well, a lot of people aren't getting treatment on for depression because of these black box warnings. And so it's just very concerning the way we have this sort of tainting of the research process by commercial interests. And it's very hard to separate those out to determine what's the truth about the drug and what is fiction, what's, you know, fabricated marketing message. Certainly the drug companies don't like this information floating to the top. They prefer this to stay down. But along those lines, one of the things that was really a shocking revelation from this data, while we're talking about studies, because studies are well controlled, and arguably you can get information during a clinical trial that may be more reliable than post-marketing surveillance. At least that's the position adopted by some. So it's very significant that in my research, they found three separate homicides. Actually, one of them was a multiple homicide, but three separate adverse event reports associated with antipsychotic drug trials.
Wow.
So the first case was a Dutch trial, and it was for haloperidol. So it was called Oros haloperidol. Oros is, you know, Janssen's extended release mechanism. They call it osmotic release oral system. So the report said in the case narrative that treatment with Oros haloperidol was started during a trial, in parentheses, that had been closed, and the treatment was continued because of the patient's good response, end quote. So to give you some backdrop, as you're well aware, Janssen, which is a division of Johnson & Johnson, had a blockbuster antipsychotic called Risperdal or Risperidone. Well, paliperidone is an active metabolite of that drug. So this is another one of those cases that we talked about a little earlier where the FDA approves the drug. And in fact, in late 2006, the FDA did grant this active metabolite of a previously approved drug, risperidone, a 5-year new chemical entity exclusivity, which went through 2011. The only problem, Dr. Bregan, is during this trial, the subject murdered someone. So the report elaborates that, quote, the patient murdered his wife, end quote. Now, this is the kind of outcome that usually doesn't bode well for primary endpoint efficacy in a trial. But the problem here is that this trial had already been closed, so it raises a lot of questions and exposes, I think, some of the systemic flaws with the FDA's approval process. Namely, that, you know, the FDA can approve a new drug application based on these short-duration trials, and that a company can have a dozen trials and 10 of them are bad, they only have to show 2 good trials to the FDA to get it approved. So you can have serious adverse events that occur during these short duration trials after they've been closed. And these applicants, they're only required to provide, you know, two successful trials. Many of them don't post the results on clinicaltrials.gov, and most of the studies aren't published in medical journals. And so with no independent testing for the drugs prior to approval, it's really hard to trust the integrity of the trial data, especially when we find out after the fact that, oh, yeah, by the way, during this trial, the paliperidone trial subject killed his wife.
Let's make clear that the drug company is required to report that kind of event to the FDA, you know, regardless of when or where it occurred. So it got reported to the FDA, but you're saying it didn't get taken into account?
Well, that's where we're left to speculate, right? This could be a case of left hand, right hand. I will...
This is not in the label for paliperidone.
That's correct. It's not in the labels. And if you look at the new drug application, the approval of the new drug application for paliperidone, it figures nowhere in there either. And so it really leads to other questions. Was this, was this trial cloaked as a success? Since, remember, the patient's homicidal endpoint measurement was his endpoint measurement was good response, and that's why they continued the treatment. Or did they maybe retroactively close the trial at an earlier date to hide this serious adverse event, you know, beyond an arbitrary endpoint? How long was the trial? How many subjects were in the trial? So, you know, was this an open label or blinded study? I mean, there's a lot of questions about this, and it really does expose some of these systemic flaws. And I will tell you this, Dr. Bregan, I had a case that I had to request from the FDA over and over again, because the case was for a 64-year-old man who was on an antidepressant who committed murder from the Netherlands. And I kept getting this case back from the FDA of a 73-year-old woman from the U.S. who had macular degeneration. I mean, you couldn't get anything further apart. And the reason I kept getting it is the FDA has a system called an ISR, Individual Safety Report, and they had put these two reports together under the same case number. In other words, Dr. Bregan, the FDA was completely oblivious to this report of the 64-year-old from Netherlands until I pointed it out for them and they assigned a new case number. So this could be, it's entirely possible this is a case of, you know, left hand not knowing what the right hand is doing. You know, the medical reviewers for the new drug application aren't necessarily the same people who are reviewing the post-marketing surveillance reports.
Oh, they're not. They're actually not the
well,
same.
Well, it's under the same roof, the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, but it may not be the same, you know, medical reviewers.
No, I don't think so. No, they're specialized. And the medical reviewers are looking in depth, supposedly, at the new drug application and determining safety and efficacy as separate issues. And I think that the follow-ups that are done, the following on the post-marketing reporting, I suspect most of that's run through computers. I wonder if there's even any one person who is doing anything other than maybe looking for oddities in the computer reporting to suggest new adverse effects. That'd be interesting to know how it's gone about, but it certainly isn't going to be the reviewer. I don't believe that would happen.
And sometimes it's just a public outcry. You remember the case of mifepristone or Suzone, which was an antidepressant that was removed from the market after Public Citizen filed a petition because of all the patients who were dying of liver failure.
Yeah.
So a lot of times, like with Vioxx, there's a public outcry, and then the FDA will take a look at it. Well, to critics who would counter that you can't indict the antipsychotic drug Invega, much less an entire drug approval process, on account of one murder, committed by a clinical trial subject. I would offer a second case. So, tragically, there was another paliperidone homicide. So in addition to passing off these molecular tweaks as a novel drug to extend the exclusivity, another trick that the pharmaceutical companies play to prolong a drug's profitability is to modify the drug's time release, change the delivery mechanism, the dosage, or the administration route. So that was the case here with Invega, a drug called Invega Sustenna, which is a once-a-month intramuscular injection of paliperidone, palmitate, that's been approved for schizophrenia. Now, this is kind of interesting because this long-acting intramuscular injection has been a favorite of, kind of trumpeted for by proponents of coerced drugging as a means of guaranteeing that the individuals take the medication.
Right.
So this is something that's cited quite a bit for assisted outpatient treatment, so-called. So it's interesting to note the FDA approved Invega Sustenna in mid-2009, but they deferred the completion of a pediatric study of schizophrenia patients aged 13 to 17 until 2013, over 4 years after the drug was approved. So this case is related to that deferred study. So the drug's been on the market for 4 years, and in this case narrative, it elaborates that, quote, the reporter considered the patient had a lack of efficacy based on primary endpoint in efficacy clinical trial, in parentheses, possible lack of efficacy, end parentheses, end quote. You think? So, in addition to reporting an adverse event of homicide, the principal investigator, the medical doctor, listed drug ineffective as a side effect. And this particular patient killed his mother. And this is in a pediatric trial. So two Invega clinical trials. I would have to go back and look at the,
that's
the
okay.
Record.
That's so interesting.
Clinical
trials,
and
Eli Lilly developed this ruse way, way back. They had their evaluators of the data take reports of suicide and reclassify them as no drug effect. So the use of this no drug effect concept is a ruse, and the implication is supposed to be the drug didn't do anything except have no effect, and the patient therefore killed themselves or somebody else. And it indicates that the reporter was somewhat under the influence of drug companies to have checked off no drug effect, because it doesn't make any rational sense to pick that as one of your adverse event reports.
That's, I know you have a lot of familiarity with that. You're probably familiar with the talking points memo from Eli Lilly that came out as a result of the Fentress case, in which they said it's the disease, not the drug. They said two-thirds of patients improve on the drug, the other third don't. Those who don't continue to remain vulnerable to the tragic behaviors associated with low serotonin levels.
No, I've never seen that memo. You're actually giving me a lot of different information, Andrew Thibault. You're giving me a lot of new information. Could you email me that memo if you could find it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And here's what's interesting, because you can turn this around on them. So the idea of no drug effect or the drug being ineffective, that's a stunning admission. That a third of the people that take the drug, they know ahead of time it's not going to work for them. So imagine, Dr. Bregan, if you went to buy a car and the dealer said to you, oh, yeah, by the way, there's a 1 in 3 chance that the airbag won't deploy. Right? So you say, well, how will I know? And he says, well, if you have an accident. So we accept these kinds of really unacceptable scenarios from the drug companies that we would never accept from an automobile manufacturer. And the drug companies will counter, yes, but there are millions of people who take these drugs and they don't go out and kill somebody. Well, to use the automobile manufacturer analogy, you have Toyota that's recalled some 8 million vehicles that caused 89 deaths. And they paid out a couple billion dollars to settle the case. Do you think they would have done that if they hadn't, if there wasn't some causality in those 89 cases? So just the fact that there's a small number of cases versus the larger number of people that took the drug in and of itself doesn't exonerate the drug. But I think we have to look at it a little differently and say, well, there are two things that the FDA has to look at, safety. And when we think about homicide or suicide, we often think of it as causality. But the other thing we have to look at is efficacy. And so if you're telling me the drug doesn't work, so a person goes to a doctor in good faith and says, doctor, I have depression. And the doctor in good faith prescribes this medication, but you're telling me that they might as well be walking around taking placebo because a third of them, it'll have no effect on them. So now you throw on top of that the fact that we have these pharmaceutical industry allies in Congress who are well-funded. It's no secret. The pharmaceutical lobby is now the largest, paying some $230 million per year, an average of $429,000 per representative. And they're now claiming that we have to forcibly medicate people with this drug, even though the manufacturer itself says a third of the time it doesn't work. Now, what's really interesting is you look at the research beyond those, the third of people that it doesn't work for, and this is, you know, these are doctors that are funded by Eli Lilly, Novartis, Pfizer, and they themselves have come out and said there's a phenomenon known as ADT, or antidepressant tachyphylaxis. And they estimate that another quarter of people will stop having a therapeutic effect of the drug. And the theory is that it's due to, a chronic use or tolerance that's built up to the drug. And even go so far as recommending drug holidays for treatment-resistant depression, which I think is interesting. Put another way, it's the treatment for treatment-resistant depression is not to treat. But so I think this issue of efficacy gets overlooked. And it's certainly possible that the person's disease cause them to act out in a terrible manner, but they're taking a drug that was supposed to resolve their symptoms and it didn't, and that can't be overlooked.
I think that's very important, and I want to emphasize for the our listeners something that I'm sure Andrew already knows, which is the antidepressants, they just don't work. I pointed out in talking back to Prozac that a review of the actual trials for Prozac, one could only come to the conclusion that the drugs didn't work at all, and that the only two trials where they marginally seemed to do something out of all the trials they tried, they had illegally given the people tranquilizers, which are going to, in the short run, of course, relieve some of the symptoms that people are suffering from being depressed, such as insomnia and agitation and anxiety, which go along with being depressed. And you're going to get at least a few weeks relief before it gets worse on the benzos. So the drugs don't work. And then I had on the radio on a show on June 8th, Irving Kirsch, and Irving has done a series of studies of all of the antidepressant studies done for FDA approval, including those which had to be submitted but weren't submitted for efficacy. Because you have, if you do 10 studies, you have to submit them all for the adverse event review, but you don't have to submit them for efficacy. You just need two. So the drugs don't work. On top of everything we're talking about here, the drugs don't work. And anybody interested in this should really go back and look at the June 8th show, which you can get on PRN-FM or on Podbean, P-O-D-B-E-A-N. This has been a really excellent review of many of the issues surrounding homicide and psychiatric drugs, violence and psychiatric drugs. My guest, Andrew Thibault, T-H-I-B-A-U-L-T, co-founder of Parents Against Pharmaceutical Abuse. I've never taken so many notes from one of my own shows ever, Andrew. This is very, very valuable work, and I have some ideas what to do with it next, so let's talk in the next day or two. We have about 2.5 minutes left, and I want to make sure that you get to say everything you want on this subject or as a closing remark. So you got about 2 minutes left.
Okay. Well, really quickly, I will say there is one other antipsychotic trial that resulted in homicide. It was a 49-year-old male on Seroquel. And the other trick, besides molecular tweaks and then changing the administration route that these companies employ to extend the exclusivity, is to add an indication. And so that was the case for Seroquel. They were testing it. In fact, if you look at Seroquel now, you won't even find in the marketing materials, much reference to psychosis. It's mostly marketed as a drug for a major depressive disorder. This individual killed his parents and then committed suicide during the trial. But the other thing I wanted to mention is something we briefly touched on yesterday, Dr. Bregg, and you know, we can explore this further. But one of the other discoveries that I made in reviewing this data was that there seem to be certain drug cocktails that seem to be more problematic than others. And that's significant because most of the clinical trials, exclusionary criteria is that you're taking another psychotropic drug. These drugs are essentially tested in a vacuum, whereas in reality, you know, polypharmacy is becoming more of the norm than the exception. So the top three cocktails, if you will, were antidepressants plus an anxiolytic, and that was almost 24% of the cases. And then antidepressants plus hypnotic sedatives, and that was about 19% of the cases. And then antidepressants plus antipsychotics, so that was a little over 10%. So that's another thing that we're not really taking into consideration, and I know that the FDA hasn't looked closely enough at, is how do these drugs interact together?
No, you're certainly right. They don't look at that at all. And they know there's going to be polydrug use all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Any other thoughts before you finish up? Let me say again, go to Andrew Thibault's article on Mad in America. It's excellent and is really, really worth reading. Are you going to be coming out soon with any follow-up?
Most definitely. And the litigation against the FDA is continuing, so I'll keep you posted on that. But if I could, I'd like to make a quick plug for the website for the group. It's pharmabuse.com or P-H-A-R-M-A. BUSE.com. And then we have another website dedicated just to the homicidal reactions. It's called MurderMeds.com.
MurderMeds.com. Andrew Thibault, thank you so much for being on the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. A great show. Thank you.